Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is a highly respected climate scientist who's written a provocative book that looks ahead to mid-century. Lawrence C. Smith is a professor of geography and earth and space sciences at UCLA and the author of The World in 2050, Four Forces Shaping Civilization's Northern Future. It's published by Plume. The four forces: population demographics, higher resource demand, globalization, and climate change. Those four forces will likely affect energy technology, water supply, immigration, and a transfer of wealth from west to east. It will also mark the emergence of a new region, the Northern Rim, the northern United States, Canada, Scandinavia, and the Russian Federation, making it a place of higher human activity and global strategic value. Lawrence Smith has published over 60 peer-reviewed articles, including in the journals Science and Nature, and his work featured prominently in the fourth assessment report of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He'll be a guest of the University of Tulsa giving the Powell Lecture this Sunday at 7:30 in the Lorton Performance Center on the TU campus. Admission is free. It's part of the regional meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, as well as the TU Research Colloquium. Lawrence Smith is my guest today. Lawrence Smith, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Rich. Thanks for having me.
You begin your book on the world in 2050 by talking about this event that has happened a couple of times now. First was in 2008, I believe, when a hunter shot what he thought was a polar bear. But on second examination, it was not exactly a polar bear. And you say this is a great metaphor for what is happening, we're likely to see over the next half century. In this case, it was a hybrid species between polar bears and Alaskan and northern brown bears, or the pizzly bear, if you will.
Yes, this was a truly remarkable event that happened in the spring of 2006 when his name is James Martell. He's a big game hunter from Idaho and takes a lot of money, but polar bear hunting is legal in Canada. He paid the permit fees to shoot a polar bear. He had permission to do that, but upon closer inspection, after his guides led him to what they thought was a polar bear, and he successfully shot it. Upon closer inspection, they saw that things were not quite right. It was white. It looked well enough like a polar bear at first, but it had a humped back and dark patches under its eyes and long black claws. And indeed, it turned out after genetic testing that this was the first ever documented polar bear-grizzly bear hybrid seen in the wild. And furthermore, in the spring of 2010, a second specimen was shot. And this one was the offspring of one of those. So these creatures are not sterile. They are reproducing. Now, only time will tell whether this is a, was induced by climate change, which is causing species to move further north, or whether it's just a local oddity. No reputable scientist would take two events in a vacuum and attribute them statistically to anything. But what I do trust are these meta-studies that have crunched the numbers on decades of biological census data and survey data and shown that on average the world's mobile plant and animal species are moving north at a rate of about 6.1 kilometers per decade. Now that may not sound like much to you, but it translates to about 5.5-6 feet per day. So imagine coming outside of your house every morning and seeing that your lawn has crawled north by 6 feet per day. This is a very fast ecological transformation. And it's going on right outside your window.
And that's holding true for all species, from migratory birds to mammals to plant species. They're all moving up in elevation and northern in latitude.
That's just the average number. Yeah. Some are moving much more. Fishes, for example, some of them have spread north 500 to 600 kilometers. Some of the slower moving species have hardly moved at all. But on average, these shifts are taking place, and it's really quite dramatic.
Give us a sense of why you decided to write the book. You're a geographer. You state that up front. You're a climate scientist, geosciences. What made you decide to write this book, the title of which suggests perhaps maybe futurist as well, The World in 2050?
Yeah, the 2050 is a wonderful time frame to target because it's far enough out in the future that some of the big repercussions of today's actions really become apparent, right? It's also near enough in the future that it's well within the realm of our projective capability, both from computer models of climate, for example, but also models and projections of our human population, the number of people on Earth, the rates at which different countries are growing, 2050 is not that far away, and many of those projections are hardwired into the birth rates and statistics of today. So it's far enough in the future that we can see the outcomes of our trajectories, while at the same time being close enough that it's well-grounded in science, not science fiction.
You say four major forces will shape the world by mid-century, and that is population demographics. We've talked all about how our exploding population, but in many parts of the developed world, it's the opposite issue. Rather than exploding populations, it's population contraction and aging. You look at the diminishing global resources and the higher demand that's likely to happen. The globalization, the fact that we are interconnected world economy, and of course, climate change. Which of these are the most important, do you think?
Well, all four of them are important, and they align in some very interesting ways and surprising ways around the world. In fact, I think one of the real benefits of my book, in a way I put this together, is that I do consider all four of these very powerful trends that are shaping our future. A fifth one, of course, is technology, which is usually what leaps everyone's mind when we think about the future. But setting Internet aside, technology sometimes receives outsized weight in people's thinking about the future. The other four forces, population and demographics, the demand for natural resources, a globalized business model, and climate have always shaped the course of human civilization in the past and will continue to in the future alongside technology. And a strength of this book is that it looks at all four of them, rather than taking any one of them alone. There are whole books on population, there are whole books on natural resources, and whole books on globalization, and whole books on climate change. But when we look at their interaction and how they line and align in some very powerful ways around the world, we get some big surprises. For example, take the country of Canada, where all four of these forces line up in some very interesting ways and lead us to think about a part of the world that's not China and India that perhaps is flying beneath the radar of many people.
Canada has a fairly young population, and they encourage immigration. So they have and this is one of the other things, is the competition for global immigrants will spell success or failure for a lot of developed countries by 2050 because the birth rate is so far low for most of these countries.
That's exactly right, Rich. And it's hard to imagine today, while we're still struggling with recession, and here in the United States, immigration remains a contested and controversial topic. It's a controversial topic even more so in other countries like Germany and Russia. Yet, believe it or not, by the year 2050, the developed countries will be in competition with each other for skilled immigrant labor, if they are to grow or even just stabilize their populations and furthermore meet their labor market needs, because all of these countries, ourselves included, are aging to varying degrees. Our age structures are becoming more elderly as we look forward. So it seems hard to believe, but the developed world will be competing for skilled immigrants in the future if our current business model is to prevail.
And as far as Canada is a global society, it has many different cultures. It also has great resources, as we're fighting about now politically over the tar sands, lots of oil in the far north, and this is where climate change begins to make inroads. You talk about species moving northwards, various plant and animal species. You also say that people will be moving northward.
Well, they already are, and I see you've been to Canada. You recognize how multicultural it truly is now. Canada today is not our grandparents' Canada. If you visit the southern capital cities or the large cities, say Toronto, Vancouver, for example, these are thriving multicultural places. And as a result of Canada's very hard-nosed immigration policy and aggressive immigration policy, it actually possesses one of the fastest-growing countries in the developed world, on a proportional basis, of course. Canada has a small population, only around 33 million or so, but that population is projected to grow nearly 30% between now and 2050, which is very fast for a developed country, putting it on par in a proportional basis, of course, with India. Much smaller population, but in terms of percentage, it's a fast-growing country. And it's because it's driven primarily by this aggressive immigration policy. That's one of the four forces that lines up favorably for Canada, but the other three do as well. In terms of natural resources, Canada is is an enormous country. It has enormous stocks of mineral wealth and hydrocarbon wealth. You mentioned the tar sands, also called oil sands, depending on your point of view. These are, I stay out of it. I'm just kind of a factual person. But there's no question that these deposits loom huge in the future of North America. The estimated proved reserves of oil equivalent in these unconventional oil deposits is around 175 billion barrels. It is unconventional oil, but if you compare that with the conventional oil supplies of other countries in the world, it would rank Canada the second largest in terms of hydrocarbon endowment on Earth, second only to Saudi Arabia. But there's no denying the environmental impact of extracting this stuff is much more severe than conventional oil. You know, at the moment, it looks like these deposits will be developed, and the question is, you know, when or where, and it may stop yet. Who knows? But that looms large for Canada, but as well as many other things, mineral wealth and even water wealth. As we look forward in this century, water will be one of the great challenges for the world. And the northern countries are already water-rich today, and in the future they will be even more so relative to their southern neighbors.
You know, I've heard water as being the next commodity for 20, 30 years, and yet it really has not seemed to be that demandable commodity that everybody's been talking about for the last 30 years. Why do we think it will be that big important commodity by 2050?
Well,
the way you write about in the book, which is that water is going to be a tradable commodity, that countries that have it are going to be selling it, and those that don't are going to be willing to pay any price to have it.
Yes, I'm really glad you made that point. Water is, you know, why does it not seem to fall in the same category as oil? And it's popular, for example, to refer to water as blue oil and think about it as a commodity. But the problem with that thinking, of course, is that unlike oil, water is endlessly returned to us and recycled via the hydrological cycle. So as long as we don't pollute it badly, it always returns to us somewhere in useful form. So it's a much more forgiving commodity in the sense that if we manage it wisely, we can indeed get what we need. But the real problem for the future is not that there won't be enough water on Earth. It's that the fastest population growth and industrialization is taking place in places that are already water-stressed today. Imagine, China, for example.
Southern India.
And India. I mean, the groundwater levels in India are falling at an unprecedented rate. It's really a collision course there, because it's only through the tapping of those fossil groundwater reserves that food production is able to keep up with demand. So this is a tremendous problem for the more populous parts of the world. And I do argue in the book that while the water trade will become even more important to world security than it is today. And while bulk water transfers are potentially feasible in a few places in the world, and I do talk about some of them, one of them being the revival of an old Soviet plan to aqueduct Ob River water south to the area of the Aral Sea, which, as you know, is extremely desiccated. And there's also talk of another plan in the eastern Hudson Bay area of Canada, perhaps routing some of that water to the Great Lakes. But those would be minor relative to the much more important global water trade that's already taking place right now in the form of food. This is virtual water. This is water that is used to grow crops in places where water stress is not apparent or is not insurmountable, and then that food is exported to the parts of the earth, parts of the world that do not have enough water to grow their food. And this is why the Middle East, for example, is able to sustain the population that it has. The Middle East has way more people, sustains way more people than it could ever feed on its own. And it does so through the purchases of grain from other countries. And so the United States, Canada, and Russia, these are big grain producers and granaries, really, for the world. And it's something that countries and politicians don't like to talk very much about, this incredible interdependency that the world's countries have on each other for water, but it's virtual water in the form of food.
Is that at risk if we have disruptions due to climate change?
Climate change, all of the model projections show that climate change is likely to become an additional irritant and exacerbate problems, particularly in, as you would guess, the poorer countries that already have so little resilience today. By my arguments, the global food trade would actually be another form of resilience against climate change disasters or climate change-induced famines, which would be triggered by floods and droughts. Africa, all of the studies suggest that Africa, of course, is the most vulnerable to these types of disruptions. First of all, because so much of their real income is tied up in the purchase of food, so they have they don't have deep bank accounts and relatively cheap food the way we have here in the United States, for example. If the price of corn goes up a little bit, it really doesn't affect us in a very serious way, but it greatly does for many sub-Saharan Africans. So there's that issue and the income disparity. And the second issue, of course, is that where populations are very dependent on local food production and local crop success, then failures become a much more problematic and can result in real problems, stress, or even famine and the need to migrate in some cases. Whereas when you go down to Trader Joe's or Walmart or wherever you shop, and your food is coming from wherever the global supply chain can secure it and route it to you as cheaply as possible, you are much less susceptible to climate change or a climatic-induced food shortage, for example.
My guest today is Lawrence Smith. He's a professor of geography and Earth and Space Sciences at UCLA and the author of The World in 2050. He'll be lecturing as a part of the TU Research Colloquium in a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The lecture takes place Sunday in the University of Tulsa's Lorton Performance Center. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. The World in 2050 has been creating quite a stir, because one of the things you talk about is that with climate change and sort of the inertial resistance by the world as a whole to deal with these issues, you're going to see the emergence of a new region, just as important as the Mideast has been over the last 30, 40 years through OPEC and the emergence of the Pacific Rim over the last 20 to 30 years. And you call it the Northern Rim, and it's the northern United States, Canada, Greenland, Denmark, Iceland, Scandinavia, the Russian Federation. This area above the 45th line of latitude, the northern part of the northern hemisphere, why will these countries emerge? Why won't it be the far south as well? You know, there's not that much land, maybe Argentina, I guess, maybe South Africa, I suppose, Australia and the like. Why won't we see an emergence there?
Well, yeah, the perhaps surprising outcome of my research is the economic growth and rising strategic value and importance to the world of these northern countries, what I call the Northern Rim. My acronym for them is the NORCs, which is a takeoff of which stands for Northern Rim Countries, as a takeoff of the BRICS.
Yeah.
And it turns out all four of these forces align to varying degrees and in different ways around this so-called Northern Rim. With the exception of Russia, all of the populations of these eight countries are either stable or growing. They have abundant natural resources. With the exception of Russia, all of them are highly globalized and well-equipped to play in a world that follows the global business model. These countries do stand to experience some positive climate changes in addition to negative ones. I'm certainly not suggesting climate change is all good. Even for these countries, I'm not suggesting climate change is all good. But there are some advantages, particularly with regard to shipping in the Arctic Ocean, for example. And the reason these countries, this northern rim, as I call it, is so much more poised to change and transform than southern countries you named is that they possess a huge landmass and a much larger population and a much greater store of resources in general. It's an enormous, just look at a globe at this landmass north of the 45th parallel. You'll see vast continents and very large areas.
Well, give us a sense of what advantages you've mentioned shipping. Obviously, you're thinking about a Arctic that is least navigable through the summer months across it, or the ice pack either disappears or is greatly diminished. Give us a sense of what sort of the advantages they have.
Well, one of the advantages they can expect is a slightly more viable shipping season in the Arctic Ocean. These places, like the Northwest Passage, which is actually a collection of passages over the top of Canada, or the Northern Sea Route, also known as the Northeast Passage, which is the route over the top of Russia. Explorers and mariners have been dreaming of these passageways for over a century. These are the places where many intrepid people went and died in the late 1800s looking for a shorter route between Europe and what was called the Orient. And these lanes and passages will become more viable. However, the importance of this in many ways has been missed by the popular media, in the sense that most people, many radio shows and television shows, immediately fixate on the prospect of a shorter international trade route, something that's shorter than the Suez and Panama Canals, for example. But actually, the broader significance in my book, I argue this, that the broader significance is actually more profound than a slightly, you know, a shorter shipping route that might be viable for a few short months out of the year. The broader significance of this is that shipping and exploration and development will become more viable within the North itself. So we're going to see more fishing boats, more oil and gas outfits, more mines and communities being serviced by ship than we have before as this maritime possibility rises. And this is both a good thing for economic growth and providing resources to global markets because, you know, of course, what will be driving all of this is the tremendous economic growth of the developing world, of China and of India, which is going to drive commodity prices even higher. It's going to make some of these remote places more economically viable to develop. So that's the benefit. But on the downside, of course, there are all kinds of problems, ecological problems that are possible. The specter of an oil spill in this region is truly disturbing. An oil spill in the Arctic would never be consumed by microbial activity the way the Gulf oil spill was, for example, because the temperatures are just too cold. And we're also we're talking about the diminishing, if not the extinction, potentially, of some of our iconic polar species that have nowhere further north to go. So for better and for worse, this part of the world is coming online in response to these four global forces of population, demand for resources, global markets, and climate change.
You mentioned China and India as a foregone conclusion that they'll continue to grow. Is it possible that they may see contraction because they don't have access to any of these resources in a changing a climate situation where being north is better because they're equatorial? At least China is very close to the equator, and it is in India.
It's certainly possible, and that's one of the wild card scenarios that I entertain in the wild card chapter of my book towards the end.
Yeah.
In fact, what you're really talking about is a collapse of the global markets and of the globalized system. And of the four global forces that are projected in my work, this is really the one that's most vulnerable to a sudden collapse. After all, World War I taught us, in fact, on the eve of World War I in 1914, the economies of Europe were even more tightly integrated financially and economically than the world is today, believe it or not. Yet that conflict showed how quickly that system can unravel. It showed that leaders of countries are sometimes willing to go to war with each other, even if it means gutting their own economies in the process. So anything could happen, and a fragmentation of the global system is one of those surprises that could well be lurking around the corner and would upset some of these projections that we've been discussing, for sure.
With the contraction of the Arctic ice cap and the fact that you're likely to see more shipping, perhaps more development of the north, maybe even new agricultural growth moving northward, is it possible we're going to see increased competition in of the negative kind between these countries in the Northern Rim to exploit Arctic resources, which includes fisheries. It includes oil and gas, which is, you know, as I understand it, we don't know exactly what's underneath the Arctic Ocean everywhere, but we know there is oil and gas there.
That's right. We know there's quite likely a large amount of oil and gas there, and the stakes are high. And this has been one of the more popular ideas that has been bandied about, this notion of a competition and a race for the Arctic and territorial battles and so forth. And in the summer of 2007, this really reached a feverish pitch when an intrepid Russian polar explorer named Dr. Artur Chilangarov led an expedition to the North Pole by icebreaker. They then cut holes in the sea ice and lowered two tiny submarines, which dove 4,000 meters to the northernmost point on Earth, to the muddy ocean floor of the North Pole, to plant a titanium Russian flag. And, Rich, you may remember this story.
Yes,
this really
do.
Created quite a stir in the press, all this hubbub about the Russians taking out the North Pole, and the Canadian government was rattling sabers about building its Arctic military and so forth. Look, no one can predict or project what will happen with conflicts anywhere in the world, but what I can tell you is based on very significant geopolitical developments over the last 2 years that this is probably, this likelihood has been overblown. All of the signals that the five Arctic powers, northern powers with frontage in the Arctic Ocean, and these would be Canada, the United States, Norway, Greenland, and Russia, these five countries are signaling that the territorial disputes, as to what extent there are disputes, will be settled by science, not by flag planting, through a very respected international law called the International Convention on the Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS. Article 76 of UNCLOS allows northern countries, all countries, to petition to extend the sovereignty of their offshore exclusive economic zones if they can show scientifically that the ocean floor is a natural extension of their continental shelf. And because of the unusual geography of the Arctic Ocean, it's quite shallow on the Russian side, for example, and it's really a small ocean ringed by land. Because of that geography, it turns out the vast majority of the Arctic Ocean will be carved up between these five powers under UNCLOS, which is part of the United Nations, this treaty. So the and furthermore, the countries are all signaling that they're happy that with this law. They're following its provisions. Even the United States, which is the only country that has of these five that has not ratified UNCLOS yet, even the United States is following the rules and assisting Canada with its mapping claims. So all the signs are that these countries are not interested in going to war over the Arctic. They want to get the long lines drawn under this law. They want to cooperate on things like search and rescue, and they want to get the lines on the map because, let's face it, it's the same multinational companies like Exxon and Shell that are going to be doing the developing regardless of where the lines are drawn.
Yeah. Now, what about the equatorial countries that don't have the benefit of great wealth or oil wealth such as in the Middle East or just the people power of China and India? Does their future look a little bleaker?
It certainly does. I think the opening chapters of my book focus on the global picture, and it's a depressing one, and we could spend another hour rattling off a litany of real grave concerns and problems that that the world faces as a whole. On balance, climate changes, for example, on balance will be overwhelmingly negative for the world as a whole. And even in northern countries, there will be some problems as well. Rising resource demand, rising prosperity of people on Earth, while that's a good thing in many places, it does raise the footprint of human demand for resources globally. It increases it much more than the number of people on Earth, which, again, is a point I think that is all too often missed. When we panic and freak out about, oh, we're going to head to 9 billion people, what's more significant than that is the fact that we have a whole new middle class of urban consumers arriving in China and in India and hopefully one day in Africa as well. That's great. The standard of living is increasing, but the material demands of those consumers are many, many times greater than that same person living an agrarian life out in the countryside.
And that's the statistic that we haven't really thought about is just in the last decade, we've tipped from a rural majority of people on Earth to urban.
That's right. It happened sometime in 2008. We officially crossed the threshold to having more people living in urban areas than rural. We are now an urban species. For the first time ever, the vast majority of us have no real knowledge or means to feed ourselves or clothe ourselves or obtain water. We rely on others and increasingly multinational global supply chains to provide us with these most basic of biological services.
All right. Well, it sounds like food for thought, and we'll hear more this Sunday. Professor Smith, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Lawrence Smith is a professor of geography and earth and space sciences at UCLA and the author of The World in 2050, Four Forces Shaping Civilization's Northern Future. He'll be giving the Powell Lecture this Sunday at 7:30 at TU's Lorton Performance Center. Admission is free. That's Studio Tulsa for today. I'm Rich Fisher.